Welcome back to the second half of this here episode of Words and Movies. I hope you enjoyed your break.
I did. I hope you enjoyed yours.
Oh, it was so relaxing.
And now we're going to talk about the 2016 movie Loving. And one thing I forgot to mention, that both this and the 1970 movie Loving, is that they both have in common, is both of them are adaptations. And I'll get to the original source material of this movie after Claude gives us the recap of the plot description for the 2016 Loving.
Yes, there's actually one more thing they have in common, but I'll do that later. We open on a porch at nighttime in Virginia in the 1950s, and there's a white man named Richard Loving, played by Joel Edgerton, who's sitting there with his black girlfriend, Mildred, played by Ruth Negga. Mildred says to Richard, "I'm pregnant." The next day, they go off to a drag race, which Richard is moderating. Both black and white people are in attendance, despite it being a segregated period of American history. Another day later, we see Richard putting down bricks as part of his job building houses, and he takes Mildred to an empty field a few miles from where he lives, and there's a part of the field marked off, and he asks her where she thinks the kitchen and the bathroom should go, and she doesn't quite know what he's talking about until he tells her he has purchased that property, and he asks her to marry him. The next time we see Mildred, she is visibly pregnant. Richard convinces Mildred to drive with him to Washington, D.C. to get married. His explanation is that it's quicker that way, but the fact is Virginia is one of 24 states where interracial marriage is still illegal. They return to town married, and Richard works at an auto shop, keeping his marriage a secret. When he comes home to the house he lives in with his mother, she tells him that the sheriff is looking for him. When he asks, well, what did he want? She says, to find you. So Richard nails his marriage certificate to the wall, and that night, Mildred and Richard go to sleep together. Late in the evening, Sheriff Brooks, played by Martin Sokas, breaks into the house, and he finds them asleep. The sheriff wakes them and says, what are you doing with that woman? Mildred says, I'm his wife. And when Richard gestures to the license on the wall, the sheriff says, well, that's no good here. You went out of town knowing your marriage wasn't legal in Virginia. Richard and Mildred are taken to the local jail, and they're kept in separate cells. He's released on bail the next morning, but she is told she's going to have to stay there until they can see the judge on Monday, which is several days away. As a result, she spends the weekend in jail, pregnant and dressed only in a nightgown and a robe. Richard immediately sets out to hire a lawyer. The one he meets with says they'll be sentenced to a year in prison, but that sentence can be suspended on the condition that they leave the state of Virginia for a minimum of 25 years. At home, Richard's mom now tells him, I told you not to marry that girl, and we're left to wonder if she's the one who told Sheriff Brooks what they had done. Mildred finally gets out of jail and goes to court with Richard and their lawyer. They both plead guilty, and as predicted, they can avoid jail time if they leave town for 25 years. Since they have no choice, they move to Washington, D.C., where they can live as an interracial couple. Richard and Mildred try to adjust to the city life, but it just doesn't suit them. They would much rather live in an area filled with grass and fields than buildings and concrete. And they do try to make the best of it, but Mildred notes that she always thought Richard's mom would be the one to deliver their baby, as she does for many of the families in that area. So, Richard arranges for them to return to Virginia for his wife to give birth to his child. They drive into town, and they transfer Mildred into her brother's car partway down. Richard lies low, and then he follows behind later on. With the assistance of Richard's mom, Mildred does give birth, and shortly thereafter, we see Richard outside, and the police arrive, having been alerted to his return. They ask about Mildred, but Richard tries to lie and says she's not there, so Brooks threatens to split his skull and arrest everyone in the house if he doesn't retrieve her. Mildred hears this from the inside, so she kisses her newborn baby and hands him over to her sister, and then she comes outside to get arrested. Now, both Mildred and Richard are in jail again. They're worried about serving jail time for violating the court order, and when they're in court, their lawyer from earlier shows up just in time, and even though he knew nothing of their plan, he claims to the judge that he had informed them that Mildred could give birth in Virginia and that they shouldn't be faulted for his misinformation. Outside, they try to thank him for his deed, but he just says, don't come back. Some time passes, and we see the couple back in Washington, D.C. Mildred and Richard now have three kids, two boys and a daughter. Mildred's sister visits, but she mentions that she hates how far away they are. Mildred complains that there are no fields for the children to play in, like when she was growing up in Virginia. And later we see the kids outside playing with the neighborhood kids, but they've got to do so among the traffic out in the street. Simultaneously, we see Richard working on a relatively tall building, and he has a near miss with some falling equipment. And at the same time, one of the children is hit by a car. He's okay, but it shakes Mildred up, and now she definitely wants to return to the country life. At first, the family stays in small apartments discreetly. Mildred and the kids, they arrive first, and then Richard joins them later on, and they also move in with Mildred's family. At one point, Mildred is watching what appears to be Martin Luther King's March on Washington. Mildred's cousin convinces her that she needs to get them to help fight the miscegenation laws that make her marriage illegal and suggests that she writes to the Attorney General, Bobby Kennedy. Sure enough, Mildred does exactly that. Later on, they move to a house a little bit further away from their original location, and we see Richard up on a ladder working on the house when he sees a car speeding through the fields toward him. Now, he's thinking he'd been found out, so he rushes off the ladder and he tries to hide, but it's just Mildred's brother Raymond, played by Alano Miller. When Richard asks why he seems so frantic to get there, Raymond says, "I always drive that fast." So Richard has to admit he's getting a little paranoid now. Mildred receives a phone call, and she's told that the American Civil Liberties Union wants to take her case and help fight for her. She doesn't quite understand, but the woman on the other end says, well, Robert Kennedy forwarded a letter to them, and they will provide her with a lawyer. When she says, we can't afford a lawyer, the woman clarifies the help would be provided free of charge. That lawyer is Bernie Cohen. He's played by Nick Kroll. He comes into town, and he sets up his practice in a temporarily vacated office. Mildred and Richard arrive, and he explains how he's going to fight for their marriage and that it could go all the way to the Supreme Court. The problem they have at this point is that it's been 5 years since they were last in front of a judge, so there's no basis for appeal. He suggests one possibility is, well, they can get arrested again so they can appeal and take it to the courts, adding that the ACLU would be more than happy to bail them out, but neither Mildred nor Richard is thrilled about the idea of exposing themselves as having violated the court order. So now Richard is very skeptical of pretty much any activity here. But Bernie says, well, he'll keep brainstorming ideas, and Mildred retains her confidence in him. Another lawyer, Phil Hirschkopf, who's portrayed by John Bass, suggests to Bernie that they can reopen the case simply by asking the judge to set aside his original verdict, and if he denies the motion, well, then they can take it to the Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals. Bernie does this, and as predicted, the judge refuses to change his mind, setting their case back in motion. But as part of his ruling, the judge wrote that Almighty God created the races and placed them on separate continents, and but for the interference with God's arrangement, there would be no cause for such marriages. The fact that God separated the races shows that he did not intend for the races to mix. And Hirschkopf and Cohen both think this is going to help their case in the Supreme Court because that ruling is not based on the Constitution in any way. To get publicity for the case, the lawyer sends a reporter from Life magazine, he's played by Michael Shannon, to take some pictures of the couple. He spends the day with them, and he photographs Richard and Mildred as they're just going about their day, showing some affection for each other, washing dishes, and watching television. As the case is making its way through the courts, we get a scene with Richard in a bar with some of his old family and friends. One of them, Virgil, played by Will Dalton, tells Richard that the case basically makes him one of them, despite his being white. But in his case, the solution is simple because he's white. Just divorce his wife and his problems are over. Raymond tells him to apologize, but Virgil feels he's just telling it like it is. And that night, Richard goes home and breaks down in front of Mildred, telling her, "I can take care of you." The Virginia Supreme Court also rules against Mildred and Richard, which allows them to take the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. They're met with reporters afterwards, and they continue promoting their case. And back at home, they ask the lawyer what angle can be used against them in the Supreme Court. The lawyer admits that they're probably going to use the children, with the opposition claiming that it's unfair to bring biracial children into this world. If the marriage is illegal, then the children are, quote-unquote, illegitimate. The Lovings are not going to be present during the Supreme Court, so Bernie asks Richard if he wants to make any statements. He simply says, "Tell the judges I love my wife." Mildred gets a phone installed in the house so she can receive calls in case any news comes in. Richard continues his work at a construction site laying bricks. One afternoon, as he gets into his truck after work, he sees a brick wrapped in the Life magazine article on his marriage with a picture of Richard and Mildred watching TV. Richard looks around the site, a little bit paranoid about who knows about his family. And on the way home, he sees that he's being followed. So he speeds up and he starts driving erratically to lose the tail. But when he gets home, he realizes again he might have been just a little bit paranoid because nobody followed him that far. Time passes by, and finally, Mildred gets a phone call telling her the Supreme Court has struck down this country's last segregation laws unanimously. Mildred remains stoic and polite, but she is very happy at the news. We next see Richard laying bricks again, but this time it's on the house he was planning on building for Mildred and him at the beginning of the film, in Virginia, with their now family of five. Over titles, we learn that Richard died in a car accident just 8 years after the decision was handed down. Mildred never remarried and was generally press shy until her death in 2008, but in one interview, she did say about Richard, "I loved him. He took care of me." And before the credits, we get a still of the real-life Richard and Mildred in one of the photographs taken for Life magazine.
So, believe it or not, the story of the movie being made starts with a little-known movie from 2009 called Main Street, which featured, among others, Colin Firth. This is a movie that I have never seen, and it did not get good reviews at all, nor did it do particularly well at the box office. But it was made in Durham, North Carolina, and that is the movie, as I said, starred Colin Firth, and that's where Firth first learned about the story of Mildred and Richard Loving. And coincidentally, Firth also happened to meet a documentary filmmaker by the name of Nancy, I think her name is pronounced Bjorski, but anyway, she did a documentary on Sidney Lumet a few years ago that's worth watching if you haven't seen it. And she was inspired to make a documentary about the Lovings after reading an obituary for Mildred Loving after she passed away. And the two of them decided that after Bjorski made her documentary, which is currently streaming on Max right now and is called The Loving Story and is also well worth watching, that the two of them would try and make a feature film of the story of the Lovings, with Firth on as producer. And eventually they found their way to Jeff Nichols, who has been, or was, he hasn't made a movie since Loving, I don't think, although he's had a couple things in development, was at the time one of the most critically acclaimed American independent filmmakers around. He's made movies like Shotgun Stories, Mud, Take Shelter, and the movie he did right before Loving, Midnight Special. Now, I must confess here that while I certainly think Nichols is talented, none of his movies completely worked for me before this. Even Midnight Special, which was the best of the movies for me that he did for me before this, and which I rewatched last night, the night before we recorded this, I had some issues with. But because he was a Southern filmmaker and because Firth and Bjorski decided that they could trust him with the material, they asked him to make it. And while Nichols usually creates his own projects, he decided to tackle this one after he realized how much the story interested him. And this goes in a different direction than you might expect, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But first, you know, I do have to say that I think not only is this Nichols' best film to date, I also think it's a very good movie. Claude, did you like this?
I did enjoy this. It was a good movie. It told a powerful story. It told it pretty simply. You got the nuances of pretty much everything that was going on. You know, at first it was a little bit weird because you had this, like, the scene with the drag race early in the film, and excuse me, there, you know, you could see that it was, like, you know, pretty much a mixed group of people, but at the same time, you know, it was, there was the white group over here and the black group over here, but Richard is with the black group for the most part, and they are interacting with one another perfectly well. And at the same time, when the white guy see Richard kissing Mildred, you know, there's a little bit of the side eye going on. So you wonder if there's going to be a little bit of trouble a-brewing right away. And that doesn't really happen. And then what happens is a little bit later in the film, you've got the scene with Richard with Sheriff Brooks. And there's the other commonality, is a character named Brooks but he says something about, well, the people in your part of the county, you know, they're all mixed up with one another and they just don't know right from wrong. So it's kind of interesting that the sheriff does have that particular attitude going on, when at the same time we have seen those four guys watching at the drag race, and second, you know, Richard's own mother. And I'm still like, you know, we don't get any clarity on, like, who narked on this couple and said, hey, they got married and they're living together as a couple. Could have been mom, could have been someone else. We don't really know. It's not terribly important in the bigger picture, but you know, I think that was, you know, that at least added a little bit of air of mystery as far as people's motivations in this film, which I think is something that, here's where I get to my point, is something that I think Nichols did a good job on, is that there were a lot of pieces moving in this particular story, and so many characters who were not Richard and Mildred were, like, behaving as though, like, this was all about them. They were the heroes of their own story. And I'm thinking of, you know, even Mildred's sister is like, you got married, you're moving away, this is how it affects me. It's not like, oh, how good for you, blah, 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 that kind of thing. It's like, God, you suck because you did this to me. And similarly, all of their interactions with the attorneys are like, you know, they're not really thinking too much about this couple. They're just thinking about, this is the case that's going to go to the Supreme Court. We're going to do what we got to do. You guys should get arrested. Isn't that a great idea? What do you mean it's not a great idea? You know, like, that kind of thing. Well, and he doesn't even have a plan B, because he thinks they were going to go for it. And it turns out they didn't. So it was like, oh, I'm going to have to think of something else then. You know, so everybody is like kind of, they're kind of self-contained in their motivations for what they're doing and how they're doing it. And I think that he actually does a pretty good job of conveying that. Whereas when you look at Richard, you know, Richard seems like, I mean, he can build houses and he can fix cars. And at the same time, he's portrayed as a little bit of, maybe, like, I don't want to say a simpleton, because that's not quite the way I want to portray it, but he's not a complicated kind of guy. And everything that he does in this film is geared toward making Mildred happy. He wants to take care of her. It comes up several times. He can take care of her. He takes care of me. That's the way it's always framed. And that is his entire motivation for doing anything that he does. And I just love the way that was portrayed for him.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get back to the relationship between Richard and Mildred in a moment. But first, I want to go back to a point that you made earlier about, you know, the way the town is set up. Historically, particularly around the 50s and 60s, Central Point, which is where they lived in Virginia, apparently was one of the few places in the state where whites and blacks were whites and African Americans were fairly integrated. I mean, of course, there was still the anti-miscegenation law that was happening throughout the state, but the fact that Richard would be working with African Americans and even spending leisure time with them would not have seemed out of place in that part of the state. Of course, the fact that he's involved with Mildred would have raised a few eyebrows, but the other part, the fact that they were so integrated, is based on historical fact. Now,
right, although it should be noted, it wasn't like white versus black. It was white and not white. You know,
right.
because there were some, you know, I think he mentioned Cherokee and he mentioned Rappahannock Indians that are also in that area. And Mildred Loving
Mildred
herself, it doesn't come up in the film.
Mixed race herself.
Yeah.
But the thing that I wanted to mention that is part of the unusual approach that the movie takes is while this movie is about one of the most famous and controversial cases decided by the Supreme Court in the 1960s. This is not a courtroom drama at all.
Not by any means.
No, there are the scenes where Richard and Mildred are in front of Judge Basil. And Judge Basil, by the way, is played by David Jensen. And their lawyer for those appearances is played by an actor that also appeared in Midnight Special and whom we've talked about on a couple of occasions, Bill Camp. Remember, he was Harlan in in Aaron Sorkin's directorial debut, Molly's Game. Mm-hmm. And he also played Brian Wilson's abusive father in Love and Mercy. And he's doing something very different from those roles here. But anyway, we get those and we get a little bit of the arguments made by Bernard Cohen and Phil Hirschkop in the Supreme Court scene. But mostly this movie is about Richard and Mildred Loving's their lives and the fact that Mildred is the one who, while she may have been, you know, as quiet as Richard and as shy, she was the one who instigated almost everything that happened in the movie and apparently in real life, according to the documentary. She's the one who tells Richard that she wanted her baby to be delivered by Richard's mother. She's the one who tells Richard that she wants to move back to Virginia after one of their children gets hit by a car. She's the one who decides to pursue the case through legal means, even though it's at her sister's suggestion. And she's the one who decides to do publicity for themselves, even though inviting the photographer from Life magazine, doing television interviews, even though Richard wants absolutely no part of it. You know, he says when Cohen first talks about wanting to go federal, he says, well, can't we just go back in front of Judge Basil? You know, he doesn't comprehend, whereas Mildred knows that's not going to do them any good. And so that's the approach that Nichols takes, because he did not want to do a courtroom drama and make the lawyers the heroes or the focal points here. He wanted the focus to be on Richard and Mildred. And one of the ways stylistically that he and cinematographer Adam Stone are able to do that is they shot this on film, and they also shot this in widescreen. So you get a look at the landscape of Virginia, and it was all shot on location, all the Virginia scenes were shot on location, although not at the exact locations, while Richmond, Virginia doubled for D.C. In those scenes.
Although courthouse, they used the same courtroom for that scene.
Yes.
And the place where, like, the exterior of the jail, also used from the original, the actual location where the Lovings were first taken in.
Right. But, and then they also do visually, although they don't get really heavy-handed about it, they set up a nice contrast between the Virginia scenes and the D.C. scenes. And credit should also go to editor Julie Monroe, because the rhythm of the Virginia scenes is very slow. Mm-hmm. And easy, sucks you into the way of life that they had, whereas the scenes in D.C. are edited a little bit faster, quicker cuts, although it's not, it's not 2-second cuts or anything like that. But
I think it's also lit more harshly.
Yes.
I think.
Yes, it is. The rhythms and the harshness of big city life. So you can see that while the children like it, and I do think Richard adjusts to it, at least because he's working. Mildred, of course, does not at all.
No,
so they did job with all of that.
He adjusts to it in the sense that, he's got a job to do and he's just going to do it. And again, he's doing whatever he can to make Mildred a happy camper, and so he's going to just get in and get the job done. And that's the name of that tune. Mildred is clearly, not happy really at any time that she spends in the DC area. And that's just the name of that tune, and the kids, the kids are happy. Well, they don't know anything else really. I mean, this is where they grew up. So they don't necessarily know that there is a better life for them somewhere else where the living is a little bit easier and the thing and everything moves a little bit more, let's say laconically. And it's just a different thing, but they have not had the opportunity to experience that. But they do seem to take to it quite well once they're there.
Right. Now, one other thing about this movie that I want to stress, especially in light of what we talked about in a previous episode with the 1950 No Way Out, even though this is set in the South, there is not a lot of the stereotypical Southern bigotry shown. The racism shown here is more casual than that. Even mm-hmm. the sheriff treats them not so much. And in an interview, Martin Sokas said that this was the way he tried to play it. Not so much as he views Mildred as subhuman because of her race. It's more like he views Mildred and Richard as being children who have stepped out of line.
Yeah.
And it's his job to make sure that they get on the right path, which is keeping them together. Certainly he walks up to the edge of using the racist language that was used in that court decision that Cohen and Hirschkopf see as their ticket to getting the decision and the law overturned in the U.S. Supreme Court. But he is not the stereotypical Southern sheriff. at all, even though he may inside be just as racist as all of them. He doesn't express himself that way. So that, I think, is a more nuanced portrayal of that type of character than we often see.
Oh, yeah, to be sure. And, in fact, he frequently refers to Mildred as that woman. You know, it doesn't drop the N-bomb or anything like that. You know, and as you say, he doesn't even refer to her as though like she's somehow subhuman, but he's not necessarily going to refer directly to her either. And that's like the kind of a soft version of that. And more often than not, like when he says like, hey, come here, boy, go do this, boy, blah, 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 blah. He's talking to Richard. So, you know, as you say, like treating them as though they were wayward children. And that's the conversation that he has with Richard in his office is really, I think is a really great example of that particular attitude of his.
Right. Now, speaking of Sokas, like Joel Edgerton and like Ruth Negga, they are non-Americans playing American characters, which has raised some eyebrows in certain circles about the fact that, you know, that you have non-Americans playing Americans. But all of them do a very good job, I think. Sokas, I've seen in genre movies like The Bourne Supremacy, where he plays a former assassin who Matt Damon gets into a terrific, long, drawn-out, dragged-down fight in the middle of the movie. And also in the English language remake of an Israeli movie called The Debt, where he, Sam Worthington, and Jessica Chastain play Israeli Mossad agents who kidnap a Nazi in order to try and convict them, but things do not go well. But again, he doesn't overplay the hand there. He does the part very well. Now, Ruth Negga, at the time, I mostly knew from her work on another genre piece, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.,
yeah,
where she played Raina, and I thought she was one of the best parts of the show. This is back when I was still watching comic book movies and TV shows, and she was very good. And in that role, I wouldn't say she was over the top, but certainly she played it at a higher level performance-wise than she does here as Mildred. You know, again, she doesn't do anything obvious, anything like that. She just plays with quiet determination throughout, even though she makes it very clear that once she's got the bit in her teeth, that this is what she's going to do. You know, she may be able to talk to other people better than Richard does when Richard is clearly uncomfortable with the lawyer's suggestion about going federal. You know, she's the one who says thank you for your time or words to that effect. Mm-hmm. And then when she's being interviewed by the TV reporters, you know, she's the one who talks Richard down from being very uncomfortable about it, but lets him know, you know, I'm doing this, whether you like it or not, because it's going to help us. She doesn't say whether you like it or not, but you can tell from her tone of voice that's what she's thinking. And on the other hand, Edgerton, who also normally plays characters who require a higher type of performance level, not, again, over the top, although he has gone over the top, but doing more in a more obvious way, if not heavy-handed. You know, I know him as giving the best performance in the Gavin O'Connor movie about wrestling, or mixed martial arts, I should say, Warrior. I think he was much better than Tom Hardy, even though Hardy got all the press. And then also in a small but crucial role in Zero Dark Thirty. And then he's also very good playing someone more valuable in Midnight Special. He apparently drew inspiration in how the character of Richard talked from Errol Morris's documentary, The Thin Blue Line, which is set in Texas, where it took place in Texas. But he communicates a lot, even though he doesn't say very much. And so he and Nega, I think, are very convincing in the roles of Mildred and Richard. The only thing about Nega that works against her is she's actually shorter than Mildred was in real life. Mildred was pretty tall, and her nickname was String Bean, which got shortened to Bean,
usually,
which
yeah.
You hear Richard and other characters who are friendly with her call her at points during the movie. But both of them do an excellent job, I think.
Yeah, they both do, and they've got a good chemistry together. They work out well, and excuse me, and I think you know, he really does a good job of inhabiting, you know, Richard Loving here. You know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, you've got this guy, he's going to be kind of taciturn and he's going to be a quiet sort of guy. And it's part of the thing is because it's, you know, it's sort of the thing he does. I mean, even when he is out there like laying bricks, it's still a little bit of a solitary kind of job, and you're just going to get in there and get the job done and do what you need to do. And actually, you know, you reminded me of my own grandfather who grew up in very far West Virginia, Western Virginia. And it was the same kind of thing. Like, he was a laborer, he was a painter, and, you know, it was the same, you know, when he spoke, it was always very soft spoken. He was a very gentle man, but he was also a gentleman. And, you know, even though being kind of a big guy in frame, you know, he never made any unnecessary movements when he had to. And this is like Richard Loving, Joel Edgerton as Richard Loving is the same kind of guy. This was my grandfather embodied, practically. Just a soft-spoken guy. He didn't say much. He didn't do much. But when he did it, it was always effective.
Wow. Okay, that's pretty powerful stuff you brought up there. Now, speaking of someone with someone connected to the story in some way, Nick Kroll, who plays Ben Cohen, he is probably best known for comedy work.
Yeah,
but as a matter of fact, his father worked for Robert F. Kennedy, and like Ben Cohen, the character he plays, also went to Georgetown Law School. So he felt the kinship for this character, and he does a good and restrained job as well. And another actor whom we've talked about before from Molly's Game, John Bast, who played the Russian mobster Shelley in that movie, also does a good job playing Phil Hirschkopf. And connection to The Wire as well, the actor who plays Mildred's father, Christopher Mann, played Tony Gray on The Wire, starting in the third season. And then the person who has worked with, the person who has worked with Jeff Nichols the most, Michael Shannon, who's just making a cameo here as Gray, the photographer from South Africa, who took the photographs of Mildred and Richard for Life magazine. Even when Shannon plays characters who are good guys, like he did in the movie Freeheld with Julianne Moore and Elliot Page, he is still normally playing them with a real intensity throughout.
Yeah.
So this is the only movie that I've seen him in where he's playing someone completely laid back and affable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know what else? It's like he's so skinny in this film too. He always usually comes off as like this big hulking kind of character, you know, and I guess he's just good at like physically imposing himself on the camera. But when he wants to, yeah, he can shrink down a little bit and he can be a bit of a string bean himself. It was kind of interesting. I was like, how old is he in this? And I realized, wait, he's already been at this point in Boardwalk Empire, which I had seen him in. And I was like, this is a different looking guy. And he was also General Zod the same year in the Superman movie. So
in a connection
on Batman versus Superman, rather,
in a connection to the 1970 Loving, he was in the somewhat disappointing film version of arguably one of the most acclaimed, most famous, and certainly one of the best novels about suburban conformity, Revolutionary Road, directed by Sam Mendes and starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. And he was universally, by critics, considered one of the best parts of the movie, no matter what they felt about the movie, because that had a divided reception. But yes, in Revolutionary Road, he's very intense as well. But here, Nichols apparently asked him if he could tone it down and be affable for this. And Shannon joked, "What's the matter, Jeff? Don't you think I can be affable?" But he is. He's very good at this. Now,
I also like the way his character kind of jumps back and forth between very obvious about taking some of the photos and very not so much about the others. So, you know, at one point when Mildred is washing dishes and they're just sitting there, standing there chit-chatting, and he's talking to her as she washes. And at one point, he just like picks up the camera, takes a photo of her. And then later on, when they're watching TV, you know, he's sitting there like enjoying, they're watching, what is the Andy Griffith Show, I think it was. And
yes.
And he's like very slowly bringing the camera into place. And he's kind of doing it as a point and pray kind of photo because, you know, you didn't get little screens that showed you what you were looking at. He just sort of held the camera up and pointed and waited for like a noisy spot on the show, like when the Lovings were laughing out loud, to click that shutter so that they never caught that they were being photographed at that point. I thought it was just a neat little move on his part. And that also being the photo that we see at the end of the film.
Right. Well, that is the most famous photograph taken the two of them. Now, this was not the first version of their story made for film. And I'm not just talking about the documentary. There was also a movie made for Showtime, I believe, called Mr. and Mrs. Loving, starring Timothy Hutton as Richard Loving. I did not get a chance to see that movie. Apparently, Mildred Loving did not think much of that movie. She said the only thing that the movie got right, as far as she was concerned, is that she had three children.
But okay.
Have you seen it?
I have not, no.
Okay. Now, I want to mention the real life implications for this decision as well. This came up when the movie was being developed. And that, of course, is, or actually when it was being filmed. And that, of course, is Obergefell versus Hodges, which was the 2015 Supreme Court decision that legalized gay marriage. And unfortunately, given the tenor of the Supreme Court decisions that have been made in the last couple weeks as we're recording this, and given some of the comments that have been made by at least one of the justices on the Supreme Court, it seems like Loving v. Virginia and Obergefell v. Hodges might be overturned at some point. And that would be, to put it mildly, a crime.
Yeah, that would be kind of interesting. If you hear any stray noises, by the way, my grandson just came in. He's 18 months old. He's sitting on my lap. He's got his chimpanzee Milo with him, so he might make a little bit of noise here and there. Anyway, yeah, I did think about that, that Loving v. Virginia was really the heart of Obergefell decision. And But here's the interesting thing is, like, if you've got this current Supreme Court, and I don't want to get too political about this, if they decide to strike down Obergefell, you know, that could be a problem with Loving. And, you know, I think there are certain Supreme Court justices who might have a little bit of an issue with that, given that they are themselves in mixed marriages.
Yeah, well, anyway, do you have anything that more that you want to add to this before we wrap it up?
I don't have anything. Do you have anything, kid? Guess not.
Okay. So both of these movies are available on DVD, although I don't know how easy the 1970 version of Loving is to find. But if you prefer to watch them online, the 1970 version of Loving is available to rent or buy through Amazon, Apple TV, DirecTV, Google Play, Vudu, or YouTube, while the 2016 version of Loving you can currently stream on Netflix, either if you subscribe with or without commercials, and you can also rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, or most other streaming services.
To be sure. And what's coming up next time around?
Well, next two episodes, actually, we're going to talk about that rarest of critters, at least in Hollywood, remakes that are better than the original version.
Ooh.
And the first of two parts, we're going to kick off with the 1956 The Man Who Knew Too Much, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, and from 1988, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, directed by Frank Oz. Both of these movies are available on DVD, but if you prefer to watch them online, you can rent or buy The Man Who Knew Too Much through most streaming services, including Amazon, Apple TV, and Google Play. And as for Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, you can stream it if you subscribe to Hoopla or Canopy. According to Just Watch, Canopy Unconstrained. I'm not sure what that means.
I don't know.
Or you could stream them through Freevee, Roku, or Tubi if you're willing to put up with the ads. Or you could rent or buy them through Amazon, Apple Play, and most other streaming services. And we have our own webpage, which is wordsandmovies.com. And you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/wordsandmovies. And if you have a question or comment, you can email us through wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com. And I myself, Sean Gallagher, am also on Facebook under my name, Sean Gallagher. And how about you, Claude?
Well, I too am on the Book of Face under my own name, Claude Cole. You can also check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, at howgooditis.com. And I'm pretty sure by the time you hear this, we're going to have an Instagram presence as well. So I don't have details to give you because I haven't quite enacted that yet, but I think the time has come.
Okay, sounds good. And maybe I'll finally get on Instagram myself instead of just lurking.
Okay, but lurking on the Twitter, lurking on the other thing. Okay.
I'm not lurking on Twitter anymore.
Okay, then.
But in the meantime, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.
This is your announcer, Alexander Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Ophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Spotify for podcasters. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.